brink of bankruptcy to banks on the brink of insolvency. It's like the world has taken their collective financial wisdom and put it all in a pod and thrown it to the far reaches of outer space or something. Now, that's on the macro level, more complicated than the 20-watt bulb in my brain can understand. But I've looked around enough and discovered that there's kind of a lack of financial wisdom in everyday life, too, in stuff that we are involved in the micro level. What you witnessed earlier in the service this morning was a young couple dedicating their child to God and saying that this child is a trust from God to us. And as a trust from God to us, it puts certain responsibilities on you to teach your child particular things. One of those things being how to earn and manage money well. And because this isn't merely wisdom for passing on, but wisdom that is to be applied to our own lives, I thought that we could look at wisdom this morning that pertains to us all, financial wisdom, parents and non-parents alike. If you've got a loonie in your wallet or wish you had, you qualify for this wisdom. Now, if you're a guest today and you don't normally attend church, there's a chance that you don't understand the Bible, and that's understandable. But there is a book in the Bible called the Book of Proverbs that is full of all kinds of wise sayings on all sorts of different topics, some of them being financial. It's called the Book of Proverbs. And a definition of a proverb is that it is just a simple, concrete, sometimes pithy saying that was designed to be learned and memorized and applied to life. What's behind the forming of a proverb is the experience of humanity over time that have proved it to be true, and common sense. Very often a proverb will have meaning beyond what is obvious. A stampede proverb would be, "You don't look a gift horse in the mouth." And yet I've never received a horse as a gift. We don't tend to do that anymore. But there's meaning beyond the receiving a horse as a gift. And what it means is that you should not closely examine or question a gift that you've received because it's rude, meaning beyond what's stated. That's how proverbs work. And what I would like to do this morning is to show you five pieces of financial wisdom from the book of Proverbs and divide them into two and three parts. The first two will be perspectives, ways to look at wealth, and the second three will just be financial practices as to how you manage and make your money and so on. First, I want us to think about financial perspectives from Proverbs. Now, if you were to examine the value of the rich people and poor people just by watching the television screen time that each is given, it would become quickly obvious which group is most highly valued by the media and those of us who consume it. The poor, when they are shown, are frequently shown in deplorable conditions in hopes that others will have pity on them and help them out. But even on shows to sponsor the poor, it's all often the wealthier person who does all of the talking. And the poorer person who has a voice does not speak, even though what they said could be translated if it was deemed important enough to be heard. Instead, the poor are often objectified and described as if they were not quite people. But then you've got millionaires, like people on the Shark Tank, Donald Trump, running off at the mouth, way more airtime than they can possibly make concrete, valuable use of. You put those two divergent television portrayals together, and it betrays a perspective that says that rich people are more valuable than poor people. And yet I want us to notice what King Solomon, who wrote a lot of these proverbs and was an exceptionally rich man himself, had to say about rich and poor. In Proverbs 22:2, he writes this, "The rich and the poor have a common bond." So he acknowledges that they exist as two different categories, but then he says that they have a common bond, and as you read on, you discover that that bond goes far deeper than bank accounts and BMWs, or lack thereof. It runs so deep that it goes to the ground of our being. The last part of the proverb says, "The Lord is the maker of them all." Whether you are born and live in a pit or a palace, the Lord created you with inherent value that either having a lot more money or having none at all cannot take away from you. Can you see how that perspective could change your point of view if you're rich and how you view the poor, or if you're poor and how you view the rich? Given that we are a wealthy nation, it means this, that even though you are rich compared to others, realizing your common creation with the poor in the image of God will guard you from looking down your nose at those who don't have as much as you do. It will guard you and the children that you pass this wisdom on to from yelling out the car window, "Get a job!" You see someone sitting on the street. It may even compel you to want to share something with those who have a common creator, to assist another who is financially struggling, but you know is equal to you in the eyes of God. So wise financial perspective number one is that there is no difference in the inherent value of the rich and the poor in the eyes of God. That is worth looking, using as a perspective for yourself and passing on to your children. Wise perspective number two doesn't have to do with the nature of people, but it has to do with the nature of wealth. In Proverbs 23, verse 4, Solomon says this, "Do not weary yourself to gain wealth. Cease from consideration of it." The first speaks to those who are working to the point of exhaustion, physical exhaustion, in order to obtain wealth. And this is speaking about way more than just working hard to make a living. This is working for way more than you really need to have. It's working until you drop to obtain more than what you need. Early mornings, late nights, little sleep, skimming on relationships so that you can free up more time to work, longer hours, more shifts, taking on second and third jobs, all in the pursuit of way more wealth. And you end up dragging yourself out of bed in the morning and falling into bed unconscious but still fully clothed after it's dark. And you discover that you make mistakes, don't you? You make mistakes in driving. You make mistakes in conversation with people and just say stupid things. You make mistakes in simple calculations simply because you are so tired that you're not thinking clearly anymore. It's physical exhaustion as a lifestyle just to obtain more wealth. Okay? In the second bit, he moves from talking about physical exhaustion to accumulate more, and he talks about mental obsession to obtain more. He says, "Cease from your consideration of wealth," constantly thinking about how to obtain more. Waking up in the middle of the night, having to do an E-Trade at 3:30 in the morning, subscribing to multiple magazines or podcasts, following financial pseudo-gurus on Twitter, obsessing about how to make more, how to invest better, scheming things that could work to increase your bottom line and decrease your tax base. And Solomon says, cut it out. Now, what's the question that naturally comes out of being told not to do something that you want to do? It's the question, why not? Why would I not want to work harder to get an even bigger piece of the pie that I've got a fair-sized chunk of now? Why would I not obsess mentally over how to get ahead? In fact, way ahead. You look at verse 5 and Solomon gives the reason. He says, forget the physical exhaustion. Forget the mental obsession. Why? Because when you set your eyes on wealth, it's gone. For wealth certainly makes itself wings like an eagle that flies upward towards the heavens. In other words, wealth is powerfully elusive, like an eagle. So why would you waste your physical energy and mental energy chasing it? His observation is almost like this. You let your eyes fly to wealth, and wealth will fly away. Okay? You've probably seen it, maybe experienced it. And there are a number of reasons why it could happen. Let's think about one. And it's that your perception of how much wealth is enough seems to constantly increase. You may recall the now dead but once oil billionaire John D. Rockefeller, when he was asked how much money is enough, that the answer he gave back was just a little bit more. And his answer betrays a truth, which is this, that our perception of what comprises adequate wealth is ever-growing and so can never really be grasped. Like an eagle, Solomon says, it flies, and notice the direction, upward out of your grasp, out of your ability to capture it. I find the multimillionaires on Dragon's Den to be a great example of that. They're on the show, but they're not on the show to really enable entrepreneurs to do their thing better. They're certainly not there for humanitarian reasons. They're there to make money for themselves. And if you listen to their negotiating, you realize that it is always through a controlling partnership with or on the backs of these entrepreneurs who have worked hard to bring their product in and just want some help. They end up being taken over by these men and women who are already so wealthy. And yet wealth, when focused upon, is never enough. Like salt water, it promises to satisfy, but it only follows with a desire for more that could eventually kill you. And so the second perspective that Solomon gives us here is don't dedicate your best physical energy and your best mental ability to trying to amass wealth, because it is a lifestyle that's futile. You will not be able to get enough to satisfy you. And it may, in fact, be dangerous to try. Those are the two perspectives that I found. And wise perspectives tend to shape the way that you live. They tend to affect practices. As I looked through Proverbs, I found five practices there. And we're only going to look at three of them this morning. I thought we were going to have less time than we do. But these are three financial practices that we can adopt ourselves and pass on to our children for them to live. The first wise practice that should actually be a deterrent to the ruin that greed can cause, to see it, we actually have to go back in time thousands of years to look at how they did business back then, in particular, how they did trading and how it was conducted, because they would conduct trading with the use of scales that look like that. The product would be put on one side, weights would be put on the other, the weight of the product would be assessed, and a price paid based on that assessment. And yet the thing is, that scale could easily be falsified and misused dishonestly. One common dishonest practice was to weight the pans differently, one heavier than the other, and then you use the difference between the two to your advantage. Okay. Another thing that they would do would be to subtly bend the beam that goes across so that it wasn't true in its representation anymore. And again, you use a discrepancy to your advantage. And then there were weights that one would place on one side of the balance, and the product or whatever was placed on the other side. A man named D.J. Wiseman, in his entry in the third edition of the New Bible Dictionary, says this. He said, ancient weights were stones carved in shapes that had a flat base to them. It made them easy to recognize. And here's some early examples of it. It's hard to tell what's on the top, but the heavier weight there has a knuckle bone on the top. I'm not sure why. If you want to buy a knuckle sandwich, maybe, but there's a knuckle bone there. The second is a shield, and the third is in the shape of a turtle. So you want a knuckle bone's worth of wheat. You would understand what that weight represented. And often carved on them, as is carved on these, is this weight and the standard that's being followed. Now what they would do is carry these weights around in a pouch. But what deceitful traders would do would be to have two pouches, each having different weights for the same marked amount. And whether they were buying or selling would determine which one of the pouches they would take the weight out of, which one would be used. They would use the heavier weight when they were purchasing so that they would get more of the product for the money. They would use the lighter weight when they were selling so that they would make more money for what they sold. And the book of Proverbs hits and hits hard those who make extra money through such deceptive means. At least four or even five times this is nailed in the book. For example, Solomon says in Proverbs 11:1, a false balance is an abomination to God. An abomination meaning something that makes God mad. You want to tick God off, then cheat people through the use of dishonest measures. Proverbs 21:6, Solomon continues to write, the acquisition of treasure by a lying tongue is a fleeting vapor and is the pursuit of death. What this acknowledges, in a sense, is that you can rip somebody off with a scale without saying a word. Just put the things on there and take the money, and you really don't have to say anything. But then there's those who lie and cheat to steal. And he says that it's financially foolish and actually can lead to death. So whether we're talking about practices that use a means of false measurement or lying in order to make more than we should, God hates them both. The wise man or woman realizes that and does their utmost to make an honest living and passes that on to their kids. Practically speaking, it could mean some of these things. That you don't find and fix things that are not broken. That you use the quality of products that you promised and do the service to the degree, professional degree, that you ought to. It means that your measurements are accurate, that you stick to your quote, that you tell the truth about what you are selling and not exaggerate it in order to make a sale. It means that you say up front if the car has been in an accident, if it needs repairs that aren't immediately obvious to the potential buyer. Make a living, but make it honestly, and teach your children to do the same. There are benefits to this as well. You'll sleep at night because you'll have a clear conscience. You won't have the hassle of trying to keep track of lies so that you can tell other ones to cover it up. You'll be able to look your colleagues and your customers in the eye straight. Your children will learn to respect you and be proud of you and learn from you and copy you. Wise financial practice number one is to make an honest living. Then there's number two. I've read parts of Dave Ramsey's book by Dave Ramsey, who is the host of the Dave Ramsey Show, that has 4.5 million listeners each week. The book is called Total Money Makeover. And in there he said, And I quote, 60% of Americans don't pay off their credit cards each month. That's almost two-thirds. I don't think Canada is any different. What that practically means is that in addition to mortgage payments and car payments and the payments that you have to make for cell phones and internet and television and groceries and heat and light and sewer and all that stuff, two-thirds of the country are in serious debt. In the case of credit card debt, it's debt with carnivorous interest rates. And so it's no wonder that Solomon, as he is trying to pass on wisdom that would enable us to live our lives better and our kids too, would say this: the rich rules over the poor and the borrower becomes the lender's slave. He likens debt to slavery, because it's kind of a form of it. It's like there's always chains on you, pulling you further and further down. It decreases your ability to be free to do things, to have a future, because you can't save money for it because it's all going to service a debt. It keeps you from being able to buy something outright that's actually yours because you don't have the money to do that. This may be actually the most painful piece of financial wisdom to apply, but Solomon would encourage and push you towards it, to get out and stay out of the slavery of debt. Whatever you need to do that, do it. Maybe it means experiencing a whole lot more buyer's remorse and actually acting on it. Take it back if you don't need it. Maybe it means eliminating the mortgage that you now have by downsizing the size of your home. Perhaps it means that second or third generation electronics are just fine, that a used car that is paid for is better than a new car that is not, that the inconvenience of only having one car is nothing compared to having no debt and taking the bus, that home cooking can be easily preferred over takeout or restaurant meals, especially takeout. That a staycation with people that you love can be almost as good as going to an exotic location with them. That you can borrow things and you don't have to own them. I don't know what getting out of and staying out of debt means to you, but Solomon not only teaches that it is wise, he says it's freeing, it's good. Perhaps borrowing Ramsey's book from the library. Don't buy it, borrow it. We got lots of copies, I think, in the library. Might be the first step in the right direction. Solomon's practical financial wisdom, bit number two, is get out of debt and get out of debt now. One financial bit of practical wisdom, actually written by another man in Proverbs named Agur, A-G-U-R. And interestingly enough, it's in the form of a prayer, where he prays to God these words in Proverbs 37-9. Two things I ask of you. Do not refuse me before I die. Keep deceptions and lies far from me. Give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with the food that is my portion, and I will be full, and will not be full, and deny you and say, who is the Lord? Or that I not be in want and steal and profane the name of my God. That is such a practical prayer. You look at the whole thing and you can tell he's talking about wealth again. And the first thing that he prays is that God would guard his lips from lying and deception, potentially lying and deceiving in order to make money off people, the way that we talked about before. But then he offers up the second bit of this wonderful prayer, that God would meet his needs and make him content. He says, give me neither poverty, which we have never prayed for, which a lot of us have prayed for, nor give me riches, which none of us have probably prayed for. And what he is saying in this is, God, I want to be satisfied with enough. just satisfied contentment. And then he spells out why satisfied contentment is way better than either riches or poverty. Verse 9, he says, "Give me neither riches, that I will not be full, and deny you and say, 'Who is the Lord?'" In other words, he says in verse 9 that having too much can actually lead you to ignore the God who provided it, as if you don't need Him, as if you did it yourself, which you didn't. That the other extreme is poverty, which would lead you to perhaps steal and smear the reputation of God, not to mention sinning against the people that you steal from. Agur obviously knew something important, not just the value of satisfied contentment, but the means by which that is arrived at. And it comes as a gift granted to us through prayer, which is why he prayed. Allow me to pray this for us today, right now. And then before we close in a song, I just want to say a few more things and show a little video clip for you. But let's pray first. And again, gentlemen, if you could remove your hats, please. Father, I want to lift these people to you today for your blessing on their lives financially. That by your grace, if necessary, we would determine to take the radical steps needed to make an honest living and teach our children to do the same. To get and stay out of debt and teach our children to do the same. And I pray that you would help us to fight through the allure of advertising and help us to attain satisfied contentment, truly knowing how much is enough and be really satisfied with that. Thank you for how practical the Bible is in our lives and that you cared enough to give it to us. Amen. I hope this morning that the time that we have taken looking at the financial wisdom in just one part of the Bible has shown you the practical value of reading and understanding it. Because if you don't attend Bethany regularly, you wouldn't know this, but as a church, we're going to be taking a journey through the Bible together beginning in October, and would invite you to join us. We don't need to start it yet, Rob. Just start it in a minute. One of my friends has done this in his church for about 8 months now, and he sent me the testimonials of people who have been a part of that program and been changed by it. Talk about the value that reading the Bible has brought into their lives. We're calling our program Grow Up, which speaks just of the growth opportunity personally and spiritually that reading the Bible will bring into our lives. My friend called their initiative Eat This Book. And as a teaser for what we're going to do in October, I just want to show you this 1 minute testimony of one person who participated in this program. Okay?
Before Eat This Book, I would pick up the Bible, try to read a few chapters, get really confused, not really know what I was reading or not really understanding it, and I would just give up. First couple of weeks of doing Eat This Book, I was actually really encouraged. I was starting to recognize a lot of the stories that I've always heard from my childhood and growing up in a church, and having the support of my life group and the weekly sermons to go to and kind of reaffirm what I was reading and find out more about what I was reading, and having a forum to ask questions was really, really helpful to understand more of what was going on in the Bible. It feels really good to know that I'm not the only person who is rediscovering the Bible and, you know, talking to friends and, you know, sharing our what we've read that week and our shock and, oh my gosh, this is in the Bible, and, you know, just being able to talk to other people about it and It just makes me want to learn more, ask more questions, come to church, find the answers, go to life group, and really participate so I really understand what it is that I believe.
I've learned to read this book.
Thanks, Rob. So starting October 1st, we're going to be doing that, reading the Bible together as a church. And maybe you've never done that before or haven't done it for a long time. But the practical financial wisdom of today may have made you curious, because there's a whole lot more of it. There's a whole lot more wisdom in other areas, not to mention understanding who God is, that you may not have known before. And we would just love to have you join us. And her testimony could be repeated in thousands of lives in different churches around the country. So we'd love for you to join us. More details of this will be coming up in the August and September on the BethanyChapel.com website. We'll just have Grow Up button there with a Bible with a plant growing out of the top of it. Not a marijuana plant either. It's just a normal plant. Just click that button and you'll get all the details for what will be coming up in October. Laura, I invite you to come and lead us in a song before we close in prayer.
Would you please stand with me?